Welcome to This Is Money Podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is deputy editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, how much will you spend during your lifetime? Will Omicron derail a potential pre-Christmas interest rate hike? Will it derail Christmas altogether? We talk travel restrictions and PCRs and what's happened to shares. Tempted to join the Great Resignation? Or is it wiser to stay put for better pay, conditions and flexibility? And is your home hotter than Lanzarote? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, we know life is expensive. But have you ever thought about exactly how much? When you tot it all up, how much do you reckon you will spend during your lifetime on things like buying a home, raising kids, holidays, going to the pub, going out to the restaurants, whatever you spend your money on? Well, Atom Bank has done a little bit of number crunching, and they've come up with a figure, £1.5 million during an average lifetime now. And they've done so to show the impact of the rising cost of living. So in 1971, that figure would have been 80,000. But if you think 1.5 million is a lot, feel sorry for our grandkids, because if inflation carries on the way it is, by 2071, that figure would be 19 million pounds. Lee, what is this research about?
19 million pounds, said in Dr. Evil voice. It's research that Atom Bank have done here, and I'm going to say this. I would take this research with probably a silo of salt rather than a pinch of salt, because it's very difficult to really ascertain how much you're going to spend over a lifetime. There's so many variables. I mean, it's just an incredible amount of variables, really. But they've looked at the average UK life expectancy of 80.7 years, and they've tried to tot up looking at everything that you're going to purchase, buy, do over your life, and come up with a figure. Now, for some people, this is going to be way lower than this. For some people, it's going to be far higher than this figure. You know, it depends on your property price. It depends on
whether you get married, get divorced, have kids.
How many times you potentially get married, get divorced, and how many kids you have. If you have the taste for expensive holidays, going around the world, or if you prefer staying closer to home. If you want a fancy car and you keep buying a fancy car, a new one every few years, or you just stick with the same motor for a long time because it gets you from A to B. There's so many variables. And actually, when I was reading this story, it made me think of the board game Game of Life. That's what it made me think of. And you know, coming up to Christmas, those board game wars, you know, you get your little character and you go around and you make all these life decisions, and you know, you're going to go to university, you're going to have children, this, that, and the other. I actually had a quick look at Game of Life before we came on this podcast. I was interested. It was the first popular American board game. Came out in 1860. No, so I wonder what the inflation measure would have been from there. But, but they've tried to top this up, and they've put out a handy kind of guide here. And it is an interesting snapshot because it goes back 50 years, 1971. And has a look at the effects of inflation in the last 50 years. I think the forward forecast to 2071 is a bit of a stretch. I think it's very difficult, you know, the ebbs and flows of inflation. And the reason why I say that is actually I did a bit of crunching. We've got a great calculator on our website. If you go to thisismoney.co.uk/inflation, you can have a fiddle around there and have a look at inflation. It goes back so far, and you can look at the cost of things from any year and how much it is in today's prices, look at how inflation has changed. It's a great little tool. Since 1971, according to our tool, this is based on RPI, inflation is up 1,484.5%. Right, that's pretty sizable. In 1971 itself, inflation was at 9.4%, and it peaked in the mid-70s at 24.2%. So some of our older listeners will be, you know, when we've been talking about inflation in recent months, they're probably hearing 4% and thinking, well, you know, in the 70s. So then I had a look. We've got another handy tool on that bit of the website where you can have a look over certain time frames to see what the measure of inflation was. So in the 70s, from 1970 to 1980, it was 225%. In the 80s to 90, it was 103.5%. 1990 to 2000, 43.4%. 2000 to 2010, 29.4%. And in 2010 to 2020, nudged up slightly to 35.2%, the first time since the 70s, the decade. So this is why it's quite an interesting piece of research, because it looks at how things have changed. So we all, there's always that common sort of thing where people say, well, homes are just relative, you know, buying a house is just relative to what it was in the 70s, you know, and how much that's changed and how much that's grown and how difficult it is for younger people to get on the housing ladder. And this actual piece of research kind of shows you how much a property would have cost you potentially in the 70s to how much it costs you now. But not just that, all of the other things that you do over your life, there's trips to the pub, eating out. I mean, there's a figure here, which some of the figures to pluck out here. I mean, it says eating out in 2021, the average person is going to spend £66,000.
Wow.
Which just sounds absolutely incredible. And then I think to myself, I mean, are we including takeaways in this? Because the amount of people I see getting delivered and, you know, all that kind of stuff, food to their house, must be astronomical compared to the early 70s. Can't imagine there was too much of that going on. And then other things as well, we're talking about holidays. Yeah, okay, the last couple of years, holidays have been off the cards. But outside of that, you know, we're used to now, in this era, having fancy holidays. It's almost a way of people, you know, I'm not saying everyone does this, but people like it, like to be a bit more extravagant than they probably were in the early 70s, where, you know, it was, there wasn't as many flights, for example. You know, the package holidays were just kicking off in those kind of times. So it's a useful little kind of, you know, look back and look at the effects of inflation. But as I say, it's so hard to fully ascertain how much you're going to spend over your life. The one thing I would take away from this, if you really are interested, you could go back, have a look at potential, if you're a homeowner, how many homes you've owned over the years, try and work out how much you've paid, repaid. You know, that might be quite interesting. You can have a look back at your holidays and try and work out how much holidays are. Kids are expensive. I mean, I'll go through this at the moment. I know kids are expensive. And then there's that, I you know, do you send them to private school or do you not send them to private school? And all of those kind of factors, again, you know, very hard to kind of put a total price on the average Briton, because there's no such thing. It's just incredibly difficult. So, you know, as I say, it's interesting. And there's definitely things in here that have changed a lot since the 70s, including things like pets as well. You know, they've got the cost of owning a cat, if you had a cat your whole lifetime, is £59,500. I looked at that and I thought,
wow,
I'm not sure about that. I've, you know, the cat I've got here just lives off scraps and, you know, cheap food. She's fine, you know, she's all right. I can't imagine many people are spending 60 grand on their cats, but hey, get in touch if that's you. I mean, that's it. And going back to that, you know, you could also look forward. So if this was a
more
piece
on
of
the cats, sorry, more on the cats than the dogs. Is there?
Well, there's a dog in there. It says here.
Yeah, I know, but look, this is double. You spend more on your cats than the dogs. Is that because you have more cats, or you?
I was quite surprised.
Cats throughout your life, or cat owners? Oh, Simon, do you know?
Are cats not more likely to eat cat food, and you might feed dogs scraps more?
Maybe.
No, I don't know that. I don't know that that's the truth, is it?
No,
I don't know.
Dogs tend to be bigger as well, so they'll eat more. You know, probably cost more at the vets. Anybody
there you go, Georgie.
Cats and dogs, let us know.
There's a great Ask an Expert question. Is it more expensive to have a cat or a dog?
Well, according to Atom Bank here,
maybe you end up with more cats over your lifetime. Maybe cats end up, you know, cat owners end up having more cats over.
I tell you what, I'm not going to be owning a cat in 2071, not for 160,000.
Oh, but the joy they give you, Georgie.
They don't love you. Cats don't love you back. They don't love you back. Dogs love you. Cats don't love you.
And the last thing I was going to say, if this piece of research has inspired you in any kind of way, which I don't inspire that many people.
Do what? Not go out. Not spend. Not have kids. Not have cats.
But you do. It might be of interest of those types of people that keep a spreadsheet of all of their ins and outs and what they're spending money on. And, you know, people do that, Georgie. There's been a big rise of these kind of like money saving apps and things. And some of these new wave banks, people like to see, have a neat little pie chart, and it shows you how much you've spent on pie, you know, eating out, and how much you're spending on your rent or your mortgage, and how much you're spending on other stuff, you know, transport, that kind of thing. And it actually, people do like that kind of visual data, especially younger people. So if this is resonating with you, you have a look, see what you're spending money on, and it might give you a nice little kickstart into budgeting. But hey, if I live my life thinking about how much my life is going to cost, I don't know. I'm not sure.
It's a depressing thought, isn't
enjoyable.
It?
I would find that, even as a personal finance journalist, I don't think I'd find that particularly enjoyable.
Simon, what did you make of it?
I think it's a useful way of understanding inflation and why people are concerned about the return of inflation. I mean, if you look at those numbers that Lee's talking about as he went through decade by decade, those are actually very interesting. And the reason why we think that we're not going to go back to 1970s style, what was it, 225% inflation over the decade or something, is because we've now got it down to, what was it, like 30, 40% over a decade. And that can't happen again. But there are people suggesting that it could happen again. And that the massive wave of money printing, cheap money, funny monetary policy, all of the above could lead us into this, and that we're too complacent on inflation. And that's why there's hawks out there calling for rate rises, even though it's widely acknowledged that the things that are driving inflation probably can't be stopped by rate rises at the moment. They're saying get ahead of it. Because like some of these numbers, when you look at them individually, they really do bring it home. I mean, the house price one does go to illustrate house price inflation, because that £2,371 mark for the average home in 1971, if that had just risen with inflation, it would mean the average home in Britain now would cost £38,000. Imagine being able to buy a house for £38,000. Like the average house for £38,000. That would be great. You're looking at, you know, on according to whatever figures you want to believe at the moment, around the £250,000 mark. And actually, if you look at a chart of those house prices against wages, you'll see that house prices have not only massively outstripped wider inflation, they've also massively outstripped wages. And that's the problem. And then people, yes, mortgage rates are low, but people have to raise a deposit. And it's a hell of a lot easier to save the deposit on a £38,000 house than it is to save the deposit on a £250,000 house, you know. But then there's stuff in here that really brings it home. So your life, your 2021, 80-something, 81-year-old lifetime of further education, on average, you'd spent £13,930. People going to university now would love to spend £13,930 only on university. But in 1971, the figure was a big fat zero. Nothing. Further education was free back then. And people weren't taking on debts that were going to last them a lifetime and they were never going to pay off. And then there's things like alcohol. £14,931 now, for the 2021 figure. Sounds a lot, doesn't it? £43,906 for the 2071 figure. And then you go, hang on a minute, maybe that's undercooking it. I mean, if I spent £1,000 a year on alcohol, I'd only be spending £20 a week. Do I spend more than £20 a week on alcohol? Yes, I do. Depending what I'm drinking, that might only be less than two bottles of wine. And it's certainly not that many beers in the pub nowadays. And you're like, oh, maybe my figure for that might be a little bit higher. And as Lee said, the eating out one as well. I mean, if that includes takeaways, then people are in trouble. But even eating out, you think about it and you think, hang on a minute, how much do I spend on eating out every year? Probably spend quite a bit on that kind of thing. So it is interesting. It is really interesting to see it broken down. But it's also a way of trying to work out, well, what could I save money on? You look at it and you go, whoa, hang on, am I spending that much money on that? And this is where we talked about this a few weeks back, but this is where old-fashioned budgeting does come in, that looking at what you spend your money on every month when you're wondering where on earth all that money's going, and then going, okay, well, maybe this is the thing I need to cut down on. £10 bottles of wine, in my case, it sounds like.
Exactly.
But you can do that really easily nowadays, because if you go to your online banking, you can download your statements in Excel, and then you can sit there and fiddle around in an Excel spreadsheet and group it up and work it out. Or you can sign up to one of these money management apps that can help you and try and do it. Or some people's internet banking app banking will do it for them. But yeah, This is why people are worried about inflation, people, these figures.
I wanted to ask you a bit of a random question, both of you, because, well, Simon, you talked about it with the big fat zero in 1971 for higher education and £2,300 for a house. Is life worse now, Lee? Were things better back in the day? Obviously, none of us were around back in the day, but just curious.
That's a loaded question.
I know, I just thought about it because I thought, you know, because it does sound in lots of regards. If you think back, you know, people could get on the property ladder, you could have education for free, but then we didn't have the same choice. You know, as a woman, it was very different for my mom as it would have been for someone else, although she went off and became a doctor, so it didn't really make a difference. But Simon?
I mean, I only lived through 1 year and half a month of the 1970s, yeah. Right?
What
so
was that like?
I'm not the world's greatest judge, okay, of how good or not it was. I've seen pictures, I've seen videos, I've heard talk, and I'm aware of the things that people were able to obtain back then. Mm. And I know what you can get now. And I would argue that whilst you might be paying substantially more now for stuff, you are probably getting a much higher quality of stuff. I mean, you're definitely probably getting a much higher quality bottle of wine, pint of beer, experience in the pub, meal out. Secondhand cars are definitely better in the sense that they don't break down, fall apart, kill you as often nowadays. I mean, arguably, though, if I was going to choose a secondhand car from now or the 70s, I'd probably go for a classic car from the 70s, but that's by the by. Your holidays, your all of that kind of stuff, you're probably getting a considerably higher quality of existence now. Whether those material things make life better is a philosophical question that I cannot
answer,
having not lived properly through both generations to compare them. Was there better spirit of community? Were people happier? Was the country a better place to be? Guess it depends who you are and what you're like, because for some people now is a much more comfortable place to live the lives that they want to live, but for others back then might have seemed better.
George, philosophical podcast, you know, we like to delve into the deep questions that people want to know. Was life better in a period that you just weren't around for, Lee?
If I go by the reader comments in our stories, then most definitely. It sounds like it was halcyon days in the 60s and 70s, you know, rainbows in the street and lots of people dancing in their frilly dresses in Chelsea and having fun. I don't know, Georgie. I've got absolutely no idea. But Simon's right. I mean, you probably are getting better quality of stuff, although I think you could potentially argue that a lot of people might not say the pub experience is as good as it was probably back in the 70s, where kids were probably banned and it was full of dartboards and cheap pints and good times.
That's if you could see the dartboard through the fog. Exactly. I mean, you know, I remember pubs in the 1990s that were like that. You know,
well, I can remember pubs in the 2000s like that, because I worked at one. I used to come home from a nightclub where I used to work, just smoking howled and feeling absolutely lousy. So
I would say that while you were in the modern day pub, you're probably going to get a better choice of beer and a better choice of food and a better choice of other drinks.
I like how with all the things we could discuss about how life could or could not be better, you know, house prices, investment choices, perhaps the difficulty of deciding what to do with your future, all those sorts of things, we focus on the pub.
Well, I tell you what we need. What we need is to choose a pub, right, that's been around since the 1970s. Not a particularly difficult task in the UK, thanks to our pubs that go back hundreds of years.
Yeah, 1600 mine over there.
Yeah, right. And then we need to find a DeLorean that can go back in time. And we'll go for a drink now. And we'll go for a drink back in the 1970s and we'll see which is better.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. All right, then. From then to very much now, it was nailed on, and then it wasn't. But surely next month, we thought. Well, next month is here, and so too is a new COVID variant. So could Omicron put the kibosh on an interest rate rise on the 16th? Well, could it?
Okay, just to be clear, I didn't think that the interest rate rise was nailed on anyway. I said this last month. I was like, yeah, I don't think this is quite as nailed on as people are suggesting. You know, the Bank of England, MPC committee, experienced economists, things like that, go more on the data than the headlines and the sentiment, but it was a possibility that they might have made a little move in December, because also they might look at the data and go, well, do you know what? A tiny little move in interest rates really doesn't make that much difference
when you're at such a low level. They didn't raise it in November?
Because they didn't think it would tackle inflation. They didn't think the inflation was coming from places where the interest rates would tackle it. And they thought that they should wait and see and get more data. They're waiting for the data rather than acting ahead of the data. And they thought they might have more of that data by December and be in a better place to make that decision. Mm. Now you've got Omicron it's literally a journalist, and it's especially a sub-editor's nightmare. It's literally asking for an N in the middle of it. To make it Omicron.
Omicron. Joe Biden.
Omicron sounds much better.
Omicron, yeah. Yeah. Omicron. Yeah,
anyway. So the suggestion is...
7B.2.6.3Z variant, though, isn't it?
The suggestion is that this will delay things further. If they're waiting for the data, then they're going to have... Then the what they need to wait for the data for has changed. And arguably, if we look back a month to when we had the November rates decision, we are in a considerably worse place in terms of the whole life getting back to normal thing. Everybody was on the right. We are totally almost back to normal. Everything's going to settle down. This is great. Yeah, we're living our lives. Da, 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 da. And then all of a sudden, boom, a load more restrictions come in. And the threat is that you know, it depends what country you're in. Our restrictions aren't so bad in this country. Mm-hmm. But in other countries, they're getting much more restrictions. And there's just this sort of, how much further backwards are we going to go? Clearly not as far backwards as the initial early days of the lockdown. And even then, the data that we have indicates that we adjusted remarkably well around the world economically to a completely unprecedented scenario and lockdowns. And so we're not going to go back to that sudden crash anyway, but we could reverse. And that reversal could be more than enough to negate a rate rise.
Lee, what's your views? Have we got a little bit quick off the mark on this one, perhaps? I mean, that's a hard question for you, Lee, but one of the experts in your article says the market had started to look forward to easing supply chain disruption, but a vaccine-resistant variant would certainly mean those disruptions will persist much longer. A what? What? It's vaccine-resistant? Do we know this?
Yeah, well, this is the trouble, isn't it? Things just evolve and happen so quickly. So, you know, this time last week, this wasn't really even on the agenda. And there's always going to be variants of this, right? I'm not a scientist, but this is stuff that's been going on since the start of the pandemic. There's been little variants pop up and they become, more transmissible. And the jury is out on this strain as to how deadly it is and how vaccine resistant it is. So there is sometimes the danger of just having too much data too quickly, you know, and really sort of like overanalyzing things in a way. And it's kind of difficult to come out with a comment very early on in this without really knowing how it's going to unfold and what it's going to do. That comment is basically saying, if there was more lockdowns, if there's more people, if it is more transmissible, more people get COVID and then they're off work, then we start looking at things becoming slower again, you know, things getting made and that kind of thing. And that's what we've seen, the supply issues that really in the last 6 months have sort of reared their head, which is more of a backlog of from before. That's what that comment's going to do. In terms of a rate rise, again, I mean, it wasn't nailed on. There was lots to talk about it, and there was definitely lots to talk about it in the financial press, and we definitely talked about it quite a bit on this podcast. But it's always difficult to know what's going through the minds of the policymakers. And, you know, a 7-2 vote didn't really suggest it being anywhere near being close. Mm. And now we're just ahead of Christmas. This variant kind of spooked the markets a bit, and then it's unspooked them, and then we're kind of unsure as to really what's going to unfold with it. So I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, part of me thinks it might happen, and part of me thinks really, realistically, if it was 7-2 last month and we've got this variant and it's just before Christmas, you know,
maybe. I won't ask you when, but I'll give you an option of 3. December, mm-hmm. February, or like none of those later.
Can I have the option of I've got no idea because I'm not a policymaker and it's like sticking
it's a game, Lee. We've been playing it for like
a donkey.
15,000 years that we've been doing this podcast. Okay,
my hunch is because it's from Latham AJ Bell in the story, February. Yeah, I'll go with him. I'll go with February.
Simon?
February.
All right, then. Simon, what's been going on with the market? Shares, big tumble, then up, then I looked today, it's down, up, down, up, down, up, down. And this really took investors by surprise. I would have thought that they would have priced this in, you know. No. Were they really so convinced we were back on the route to normality?
Yes. So the stock market got well and truly spanked last Friday, fell 3.6%, biggest fall in a year. And what you largely saw being ditched were the stocks that people thought were going to be most affected by tighter restrictions. The most obvious tighter restriction is travel. So anything travel related, ranging from BA owner IAG to aerospace engineer Rolls-Royce, they saw their share prices drop dramatically. Now, they had gained quite a lot prior to that off the back of this return to normal trade. We're returning to normal. Now, the obvious wins for IAG and for Rolls-Royce are transatlantic flights, because that's where they make the big bucks. BA, you know, gets a lot of its money, and it's not just BA in IAG, but BA gets a lot of its money from people flying business class to America and back, and those are kind of long haul flights. And Rolls-Royce had been lauded in the years before the coronavirus crisis for managing to shift from flogging people engines to almost having a sort of fly by the mile kind of thing, where they were looking after the engines and maintaining the engines. And so the more miles that were flown, the more they benefited. Obviously, coronavirus was a serious issue for Rolls-Royce on that basis. But there was this sort of, right, we're getting back to transatlantic flights, we've got this stuff coming. You then saw for hotel groups, so intercontinental hotels on the FTSE, you saw Carnival, the cruise ship operator, you saw BP and Shell, oil price impact, and so on. And some of this stuff is, you've got to remember, what tends to move share prices is the stuff at the margins. It's the people obviously buying in and selling out, not the people. The vast majority of shares are just held, but there is the smaller amount, and it could be people who are either suddenly switching from risk on to risk off mode, going, right, I'm getting out now. Could be people who've already made a profit, going, right, I'll cash in my profits while I can. Things are clearly not looking quite as good for these companies, and I'll come back when things look better. It could be big institutional investors repositioning themselves. It could be personal investors. Since then, things have settled down a bit, and we've seen a choppy week where one day it's up 1.something%, the next day it's down 1%, and so on. It's what you're looking at is investors looking for direction, trying to work out where things are going. There's still definitely a bit of buy the dips mentality going on. It's not all out, right, let's dump everything. And they're kind of trying to work out whether the restrictions are going to get worse, whether the restrictions are going to ease and they're going to go, right, we acted hard and we acted fast, but we overreacted, or whether they're just going to stay how they are and how things settle down. And you can factor into that the fact that it's December, therefore you have the prospect of Santa rally. The stock market does actually genuinely tend to do better in December. Doesn't happen every year, but it gives it a bit of a tailwind. So we shall see. Whatever happens, if we tread water from here on in to the end of the year, investors will end up roughly, a FTSE investor would end up roughly about 10% up in share price terms. And you can add a dividend yield of about 3.5% to that. So that's a pretty good year. But, you know, there's a big if on whether we tread water from here to the end of the year. So yeah, it's going to very much decide whether 2021 goes down as a good year for investors or a bad year for investors.
Where are we heading, I wonder? Lee, are we going to have Christmas? And what's going on with travel restrictions?
Well, so George, are we going to have Christmas? Well, I hope so.
Are we going to have Christmas, Lee? Is it over? Is Boris going to pull a fast one like last year?
No. Actually, in order to stop this relentless, are we going to have Christmas year on year, they've just removed December the 25th from the calendar.
Yeah, right.
Quietly. Exactly. They had a quiet vote on it last night.
Each have a vote, do they? Just decide. Lee, what do you reckon?
Are you talking about in terms of travel, you mean? Christmas
was cancelled last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was cancelled last year, but I'd be very surprised if it got cancelled this year again. I mean, I think I'll be surprised, Georgie. Again, I'm not a government minister. I'm not in a decision-making process of whether Christmas goes ahead or not. And things can change very quickly, as we saw last weekend with the news of this variant. You know, who's to say there's not another variant that comes up before Christmas? Who's to say that there's something else that causes, you know, a change in the deviation of the course that we're doing at the moment? But I think the Prime Minister was pretty clear in terms of trying to get people to get boosters and trying to, you know, make sure that the festive season stays on for everyone. But there is all of that flip-flopping around about things like Christmas parties and all of that kind of stuff. And if you start cancelling those and people get nervous, you know, it could be a nail in the coffin for the hospitality industry, that kind of thing. But I think people are right to be cautious. Look, every winter, there's a lot of illnesses that go around. We've now got another illness to add to the mix and into the pot, and that is COVID. And people are probably, but on the flip side of that as well, people are probably way more cautious. You know, people are probably, you know, more aware of their personal space, of putting on a mask, of washing their hands properly, all of that kind of stuff. So I'd like to think Christmas is on, Georgie.
Yeah, you know, good.
That's what I'd like to say. But travel is a different matter. Winter getaways is another.
Are they question. Off, Lee?
I don't think they're off. I think it's very fragile, the travel industry. It really is. And actually, last month, I was reading the trade magazine Travel Weekly, actually, this morning with my breakfast, because my wife was in the travel industry, so we get this weekly magazine. It's very good. And it was talking to some travel agencies, bosses, some major ones as well, saying that November last month was the first month really that full confidence had returned to travellers to book holidays in advance for sort of next year in 2023. And it was actually some of them saying basically back to 2019 levels, which they were quite surprised about. Now, the reason, one of the big reasons behind that would be the USA reopening again for travellers. So that kind of gives a bit of a boost, and a lot of people like to go to the States. But also I think people just are ready. They're ready to get away. They're ready to go and go abroad and do something. But then, so this magazine was published last week, so I'm a week behind of the magazine. And this again shows you how quickly things change, because I know for a fact that the next magazine is going to be about this variant and what it's going to do to rock the travel industry. And we're seeing different rules coming for different places. So if you are tempted to book somewhere, or you already have, best advice is to go on the FCO website, see what the requirements are for entry. And not only that, making sure that you have the right insurance in place, especially for COVID cancellation. So if you get a PCR test, well, you have to have a PCR test before you go away. And if you test positive, what the airline policy is, what the travel agency policy is, or wherever you've put the accommodation policy is, as well as having the correct level of insurance, making sure that you've got COVID cancellation on there, or if you get it while you're abroad, what the deal is. Making sure that you've got all of those bases covered before you go away. For some, again, that will just make you go, and to be honest, Georgie, now you've got to come back, have a 2-day PCR test, which you can basically do on the minute you land. So if you land at an airport, you can get it done there. But let's say you're going away as a couple, and this is what irks people, is that it's costing a minimum probably of about £70 to get tested. So if you think about that, having to do that before you go and when you land, and as a couple, that's going to cost you, what, almost £300. As a family, if you've got children that are over 12, for example, you're going to have to pay for them as well. And that adds a lot to the cost of a family holiday. And it costs a lot, an additional amount for any holiday that you're going to take, and all the paperwork that you've got to fill and all of that kind of thing. For some people, they will just wash their hands of it and go, I'm just going to wait. I'm still going to wait to do this. For other people, they would have already pressed that big green button and just thought, do you know what? Let's go for it. And I think actually what also adds confidence in the travel industry is hearing people that have gone on holiday and have done it and have got on flights and they have gone to hotels, and it has been relatively normal and straightforward to do it. It's just that additional cost that irks people. And, you know, if there was just a way to make that cheaper and easier for travel, I think it would be a massive boon in confidence in the industry. But again, things change quickly. You know, for example, Spain have just said that they're not accepting British travellers who are over 12 that have not been double vaccinated, for example. Not everyone's been vaccinated. Not everyone wants to get vaccinated. That's a different story. I'm definitely not going down that rabbit hole on this podcast. But
yeah, right.
For some people, they'll just go, well, I'll leave it then. So
I think it's so sad though, because I think about my mum, who's suffered quite a lot from cancer throughout her years, and in her older years, she decided to make the most of it, and she travelled all over, you know, China and everywhere, India. She had a great time. She was always away, spending our inheritance. But she was always away, and we loved it and we encouraged it. And I think it's really sad for someone like her who's now getting older, and it's been 2 years. The longer it goes, the less likely she's going to get back in the swing to do that kind of stuff on her own. And I think that's really sad. But I think generally, Simon, just looking at the travel industry, I know a lot of people at last year we're sort of comparing this to the 9/11 effect and how everybody said that's it, the travel industry is gonna fall, and it never did. It went back and it got much higher than it ever did afterwards, but that was one event. This has been going on now for years, and as Simon said, you know, confidence was coming back. This feels like an even bigger slap in the face now for people who are wanting to get away. Do you think travel, and I won't say forever because who knows what's going to happen, but in the medium term, this is going to fundamentally affect the way that we think about travel?
I think it has changed the way that some people think about travel. I think that there's become a division in society, as there has with many things. Some people are just like, we just shouldn't be going on holiday, shouldn't be leaving the country. And other people are like, well, I want to. And others are like, well, you're selfish. And around in circles you go. I think the travel industry, the problem is that there's lots of people in the travel industry who will have lost livelihoods off the back of this. And that is terribly sad, because it's almost impossible for them to manage to keep some businesses going throughout all of this. Domestic tourism has been a huge boost in the UK and in other countries. So, you know, you go to France, Spain, Italy, you know, Italy and Spain, maybe less because there was more holidaying there. France, even a lot of French people go on holiday in France anyway, but they've seen a big domestic tourism boom. Some places are doing better than they were. You know, there are probably people in the UK who will tell you that their businesses are actually doing better than they were. However, I do think that the issue is piecemeal restrictions with countries making different decisions. So what decision have we made? What decision has the country you're going to made? Are they going to suddenly change that decision on you? And the testing thing. And I think I understand what the government is doing, because what it's doing is it's trying to discourage people from traveling. It's trying to make it awkward for people, really. I think there's a bit of nudge going on here. It's trying to stop people from booking trips or get people to go, oh, it's not worth going on that trip. But away from that, with the whole day two PCR testing, I think we need to decide why we're testing people and what the reason is. And if it is to stop people with coronavirus from wandering around the place with coronavirus and catch the coronavirus and stop it spreading and so on, then considering we are one of the countries in the world with the largest testing capabilities, and we have a surfeit of testing capabilities in this country, we should be getting people to go use the NHS test. We shouldn't be doing this, chucking them into the wild west of the private sector. And as Lee said, you know, it's emerged, you can do these day two PCRs on or before day two. So you can go to a walk-in at the airport. You can get off the plane, go straight to the walk-in, and then you've got to wait for the result. But the problem with the private tests is you can be waiting quite a long time for the result versus the NHS tests, where the results are very quick nowadays, unless you pay to get a faster result from the private tests. Obviously, people are meant to be isolating at home until they get their test results back. But some people won't do that. Some people will go out. It will happen that some people will go out. Would it not be better if we were sending people to get tested straight away and get their tests as quickly as possible using the NHS system? Or should we not be, if we're saying to people about this private testing, should we not be saying to them, also just do a lateral flow test the day you get back and things like that? I don't think we're putting the pieces of the jigsaw together properly. But who knows, you know, within a couple of weeks, it might have changed and they might have gone, okay, actually, we don't need to worry about this so much. We're going back to the system that we had previously, or it could get worse. Certainly, I know people who are either due to go away, or actually some who've gone away already, who were like, we're still going to go. We'll just suck it up and do it. And others who were like, I don't think it's worth the bother. What if they change the rules while I'm out there? What if I get stuck out there? What if I pick it up and I come back and I have to isolate when I get back? But yeah, I looked into it the other day. There's a place near me, £69 walk-in test, So you could go, I was looking at it for some people who would be flying back at nighttime. They couldn't have done it the night they got back. They could have gone the next morning. They'd have the result back by 10 p.m. the next day. Okay, so that's not bad. And they could get it back quicker, but it's £69 each. The real killer, though, is if you've got kids, you've got to pay for the children to do tests as well. Any kids, I think it's over the age of, I think it's five and above. And so all of a sudden you're going from doing an adult test or two adult tests to four tests. And that does start to get really expensive.
So I get the point of PCR, though, as opposed to a lateral flow, because you can pick up variants. I understand that. I do not understand the idea of you jumping off the plane, having basically spent the last few hours in a tin can with about 200 other people. But I do think if we've got this, as you say, surfeit of testing capabilities, why that has not been over the last couple of years something that we've tried to prioritise to find out exactly where the virus is spreading, all those sorts of things. Why didn't we do that?
Well, and if you look at the private tests, a lot of those private tests aren't actually being variant doing the test that they can pick up the variants anyway, is my understanding. And Tim Spector, who is the guy who's been running the Zoe study and so definitely knows his onions, has been hypercritical of this private testing on the way back from holiday thing.
I don't think it feeds into the narrative as well when people say it was just a racket. I don't think it's really helpful. But anyway, be that as it may, I'm sure we'll talk about this more in the future. But I do want to talk about the Great Resignation. That's what it's being called. Now, it's a trend that started before the pandemic, but it's sped up over the past couple of years. You'd think, perhaps at a time of economic uncertainty, that people might want to cling on to their jobs with bloodied fingernails. But we've actually seen the opposite. In America, 20.2 million workers left their employers from May through to September this year. That's a new record. While in the UK, over three quarters of professionals intend to look for a new job next year. Now, that's according to the online jobs board CV Library. So the question is, should you stay or should you go? Lee, now obviously I take with a pinch of salt when people say that they're looking for a new job, doesn't necessarily mean anything. A lot of people daydream about the fact that they're going to do that, especially at the start of a new year. But this is actually being borne out in stats. A lot of people are quitting.
Yeah, I think.
Where are they going?
I think, well, there is actually quite a big skill shortage in different kind of industries, which we've touched on in this podcast over the course of the year. And I think as well, if you think about now, we're almost 2 years since this pandemic started, but actually when I've just said that makes me feel a little bit queasy, like just like incredible where the time's gone. And people have had more time to reflect on what's important for them, and perhaps a job change, a skills change. Perhaps they've worked more hybrid than they had done before. So what I mean by that is perhaps they've been working some of the time at home, some of the time in the office, or perhaps they've been working the whole thing, the full hog at home, and they've got used to that work-life balance of perhaps if they've got children, spending more time with the children, or doing more activities that they enjoy that they can do. And they're thinking, well, I don't want to go back into the office full-time if I'm forced to do that. Or, as I say, they might just be looking for a complete different job role change. Maybe they're thinking there's industries that are going to need skilled workers from next year onwards and that kind of thing, and looking for different perks and different... It's just been a big shift. I think it's been a big shift in, as an employee, the kind of power that you wield over the employer, but it's been such a sort of suck out of like talent and especially in like senior roles in different kind of industries. It gets very hard to fill senior roles, and that then filters down throughout the whole of the industry. And some industries would have been affected by this quite drastically, other industries maybe not so much so. But there is some leverage. There's leverage for employees to be kind of saying to their bosses or saying to their employer, hey, look, I'll stay, but I want to be working, more remotely, for example. And, you know, there's a lot of places that haven't gone back 5 days a week. You know, in fact, I don't know if it's the vast majority, but I know of friends that have been summoned to go back 5 days a week, mainly since this September, and they were not happy about it.
Yeah.
Not happy about it because of the train fare, not happy about it because perhaps they've got involved with taking their children to school or nursery and that kind of thing. And then all of a sudden the summons to go back 5 days a week. But an employer is fully within their rights to do that if it's in your contract. And it's most likely to be in your contract that your full-time place of employment is the office.
I agree with you, Lee. But if the talent doesn't want to come in and you want that person working for your company. You have to respect that talent.
Exactly. But that's what this is what this all boils down to. This is what this all boils down to, the leverage that you have. And depending on your role and depending on who you are and how important you are to the business, it's almost like if that's what you want to do, then you've got to have that conversation. And if that conversation doesn't go the way you want it to go, you know, there's potential to be looking elsewhere. And that's what I think has been happening in America. And that's what's been happening to some degree here. And when that ends, I don't know. And that's not everyone's. And again, like, you know, it's very hard to sort of paint everyone with the same brush, because there are some people that are fully happy and excited and glad to be back in the office. And glad perhaps to be back in the office 5 days a week, because that's what they're used to. They feel like they work better in the office. But then you have people that say they work better from home. So it's a real fine balance of what it is that you do for a profession and whether you need to be fully in the office. Personally speaking, I think being in the office is vastly important. I think it's vastly important for younger workers who you know, get those sort of social interactions. They learn on the job. You know, they get that kind of, it's very hard to do that completely from home. But then they kind of get the argument from hybrid working, sometime in the office, sometime at home. It all goes...
It depends on the job. Lots of
it depends on the job.
Can't do it from home anyway. So that's sort of a moot point.
Exactly that. Exactly that. But look, if you're someone that falls into this boat and you're not happy about potentially going back into the office full time or whatnot, you know, there are steps you can take to have a chat with your boss or your employer, and it might not go well. They might go, well, no, that's not happening. Or they might be, if you can argue your case, if you can argue your value to the company, if you promote yourself and what you do, and if you can prove that you've been working well remotely from home, then it doesn't need to all end in tears and it's all sort of like, I'm not going back into the office full time, here's my, you know, I'm resigning. Yeah. You know, there's opportunity. It's always good to talk. You know, it's always good to chat. And even if you don't have the best working relationship with your boss or with your employer, it's still well worth doing rather than just going for it. But there's going to be more of this, Georgie. I really do think there's going to be more of this kind of, you know, I don't want to go back into the office full time, but employers, not all employers, but a lot of employers will have, you know, big offices or, you know, space that is expensive. And they'll be thinking, why have we got this big white elephant of an office space and there's no one in it? We want everyone back.
Right, the opposite of that. We don't want everyone back and we'll save some money on this superfluous rental space.
It's all finely balanced, and it's a really interesting. I think it was coined by an American academic, this great resignation, and it's one of those things that's come out of the pandemic that's kind of stuck, and I've read quite a lot about it, and it's a real interesting shift, almost exacerbated very quickly by the pandemic, bringing things forward very, you know, maybe some trends that would have maybe happened in 10, 15, 20 years have been sort of pulled forward to now, and actually a lot of people have adapted to working from home far better than probably anticipated. And a lot of people who would never have thought that their job could have gone fully remote or ever had that opportunity to do it are thinking, oh, hold on a minute. Like, this has worked out great. But Georgie, again, just
as
personally
a broadcaster,
speaking,
I was exactly in that boat. I never thought that I could do all these things, and I've done absolutely everything at home. I have to say, exactly. I'm more productive. I haven't been to the office since March 2020. I miss people so badly. But
Georgie, I miss you. I haven't seen you in person for almost 2 years. That we haven't had
doesn't
that.
Doesn't feel like it though, Lena.
And it's strange, isn't it? Like you think those 2 years have almost gone by, and like I haven't seen you, for example. I mean, I find that absolutely incredible. As someone who I would see once, maybe twice a week for many years, it's a kind of strange shift into what's happened. Personally speaking, I think that a hybrid kind of workplace is probably going to become more of the norm than either other way of fully remote or fully back in the office. I think that kind of 3 days in the office, 2 days at home, potentially might be here to stay for a lot of workplaces.
I was listening to CNBC or something, and there was a commentator on there said, the talent has won. The talent has won. This debate about hybrid, working from home, you know, you hear Goldman Sachs, all those saying you have to come back to the office. That debate is over. If you want the best talent to work for you, you have to go where that talent is. You have to give them the creativity, the things that they want. I kind of agree with that argument. I do think we're a bit stuck in the industrial revolution style view of coming to the workplace, you know, division of labor, everybody does this. I don't think necessarily that's the situation anymore. As someone who does multiple different jobs, I have a very varied work portfolio that I can do from home. I couldn't do that if I went into the office. Fair enough, if you do a 9 to 5 or whatever, 8 to 6, same job every day, then yeah, I can understand going into the office. Stay at home doesn't really make a difference. For me, I need to, because at 1 o'clock I'll be doing a podcast, at 3 o'clock I'll be doing a webinar, and then I'll be needing to write an article. So I just think that the way that we're working is changing so much beyond this, you know, narrow silo of it's like in work, not in work.
One thing I would point out about, you know, listening to an American talking about this and talking about hybrid working and the talents one and all that kind of thing is actually just how bad American workplaces are for things like holiday and for things like maternity leave 100%. And that kind of thing. You know, this country is far more generous on the whole for things like holiday and for paid leave. We get far bigger longer breaks. I think in America it's like 2 weeks holiday. Which, you know, just sounds ghastly.
Don't take it either.
So probably a lot of people do want to work remotely because they don't get a break from the office. They don't get a big enough break from the office, in my opinion. And, you know, that's...
This might be why we're hearing more about the Great Resignation over there, because actually the conditions are so bad. Because I was curiously, are people resigning because they want to retire? Certainly we've had a lot of that with the lorry drivers of disaster. Just retire, or are they wanting to start their own business? Are they wanting to go to a different company? Are they wanting more money? I mean, do we know a little bit more about this?
It's definitely some of all of those factors at play, I would say, Georgie. Like, without a doubt, you know, people probably do want to earn more money. We're seeing inflation here, we're seeing inflation in the States is surging, so people will be thinking, oh, you know, I want to
obviously thinking they can get it elsewhere.
Assuming they can get it. And then also a lot of people do look at it's so much easier these days, for example, to start your own business, to start doing your own thing. And a lot of people potentially have had the time, the thinking space to do that in the pandemic, and thinking they can go and do something alone. Perhaps they are in a specialist role and are thinking, why work for an employer when I can do this and go it alone? And I think there has been quite a bit of that. There's a bit of everything involved in this. Is my hunch. I don't know any precise figures, but I think the real key takeaway is that workers do feel like they have the leverage and they feel like that they could win over and basically take on their employer or their boss and make demands and not feel too frightened about doing it, which is not a bad thing in my opinion.
Simon, what have you made of all this?
I think that what's really interesting about it is this shift in people leaving jobs at a time of uncertainty, as you said at the start of this section. You would expect people in the position we're in to be holding on to jobs for dear life. That people did that early on in the pandemic. You know, some people were very glad of steady jobs they'd had for some time that they didn't need to worry too much about. And the thing they worried about was getting themselves up and running, working from home all the time if they were working from home. Or if you're working in a job where you couldn't work from home, it was like, whoa, okay, how am I serving this in helping this crazy world where all these people are talking about working from home and I've got to go in every day and ferry people around or see people or look after them or doctor them or nurse them or serve them in a shop and all these other things. According to CV Library, the top 5 reasons for leaving jobs now, and bear in mind these don't add up to 100%, it's one of those like what's your reason, main reasons kind of thing. Need for a career change, 42.1%. Seeking higher salary, 41.3%. That is the classic reason for leaving a job. Delayed moving jobs earlier in the pandemic, but now feel confident to do so, 40.7%. Need for more flexible working, 38.9%. Burnout, 33.2%. Really interesting how close the need for more flexible working one and the seeking a higher salary one are, 41.3% to 38.9%. It's not a huge difference and highlights what we were just talking about, but that desire for more flexible working goes way, way back before the pandemic. It's just people who worked in offices and were used to that kind of daily grind thing have now been given a taste of the other side and gone, well, actually I can do my job in a different way, and on those days I can do things like help out with my kids, or I can get some exercise in, you know, I can do all those other things. And that's where it comes down to employers and managers, I think, to try to find out what people thinking and then go, okay, well, maybe we could just slightly change things and it would make you happier. And it doesn't have to be dramatic changes, but likewise, I know people who are really want to go into the office and are being told by their employer that they can't go into the office. Mm-hmm. So you're finding people who are moving jobs so that they can go work in an office because they're fed up of working from home. And you don't have the creativity and innovation and support and learning and serendipitous encounters and all the other things, where if you are just talking to people for an hour a day on Zoom in a meeting.
Yeah. I hear all of this argument, all of it. But very briefly, how hot are you right now? Quite literally, how hot are you? Are you Lanzarote hot? The reason I ask is because apparently one in five of us admit to having our thermostats at a balmy 22 degrees Celsius, except by the way people in Norwich. Don't know why, but apparently they are the most likely to turn down the thermostat and save some money. So how hot is your home? Lee, how hot is your home right now? Do you know?
Oh my God, Georgie, Simon and I had this most boring chat the other day in the office. This is the sort of chat where you think, God, don't go back into the office. We were talking over the desk about this story and talking about thermostats. And anyway.
Exciting. What was the conclusion?
The conclusion is that the thermostat in this house that I live in never goes beyond 20. Now, the reason for that
is... Because it's broken or because you are...
No, that's just where I set it at. That's where I set it at. It doesn't need to go above 20, but it's really hard to actually get a full description of the temperature in each room, right? So our lounge, for example, is a little bit drafty from the front door. And I've done all sorts of things, draft excludes all sorts of things to try and stop it. But it's definitely a couple of degrees cooler than it is upstairs. So sometimes you set it at 20 and it's kind of nice downstairs, but still a little bit chilly in a way. And I reckon it's more like 17, 18. Then you come upstairs.
Yeah.
So it's all hard floors downstairs. Upstairs, all carpeted. We've got one of those old sort of water tanks in our main bedroom, which basically is our hot water system, so it makes it a bit hotter upstairs. And I think 20 degrees, I think it's more like 18 degrees downstairs and it's more like 22 degrees upstairs, and there's this constant battle over trying to make it the right temperature. And especially with a toddler and a temperamental sleeping toddler who doesn't like to get too hot, it can be quite a battle. But I thought this research was interesting, Georgie, because not only is there quite a lot of people that set it at 22 degrees, that's their prerogative, you know, that if they want to do that, if they've got the money and, you know, that's what they want to do, that's what they want to do. I'm not going to sit here and go, don't put your thermostat at 22 because the energy climate,
it's expensive,
it should be 19 degrees. It's the people that said in this research, and sometimes, you know, these extrapolated figures I'm not completely sold on, but it says 1.4 million households put their property, the thermostat, at 25 degrees or higher. I mean, that's quite mad. That's like
25.
I mean, I know that people are not going abroad and I know that all the PCR stuff, but you don't need to make your home the Caribbean. I mean, I suppose you could. You could go and get some sand, just throw it in your living room, get a couple of cocktails, and basically set your thermostat to 25.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I found that quite mad. I think that's quite mad. But it's hard to pinpoint a temperature. I'm not always sold. And if you've got one of these fancy new digital ones, or if you've got an old analog one, I don't know how accurate ever it really is. The only way to do it, and again, this is real boring chat, George. I'm so sorry to this. That have stuck it out to listen to me about putting thermometers into different rooms of the house, but that might be the way. And tinkering around with a lot of people don't tinker with their radiators.
Yeah,
you know, there's different heat settings, you know, usually from 1 to 5, something like that, and making different rooms different temperatures and all of that kind of thing. Boring as it is.
So what you're saying is, when you have a break from writing your spreadsheet about how much you're spending on life, you could start a spreadsheet that involves thermometers in each of your room.
Don't tempt me, Georgie, because that actually sounds like my idea of fun. Finding out the temperature of each room on a daily basis at certain time points.
I think you should do it, Lee.
I'll do it and I'll report back.
Yeah, please. Please do.
I'm off now to go and buy a load of cheap thermostats off of Amazon that are probably not accurate.
So there you go. I have to say 25 is hot. Since I knew we were doing this story, I checked the thermostat. It was 22 and a half. I didn't put it at that, but that was the temperature of the room. And I was sweltering. Mine is sort of between 19 and 21 and a half is the maximum. That's if I'm feeling particularly cold. We do take this conversation to the most exciting levels, I have to say. Simon, have you got anything insightful about this to talk to us about?
Yeah, it's 16 degrees in my house at the moment.
Blimey neck.
I just went and checked in the thermostat, which is in our lounge, which is kind of in the centre of the house. So the heating's not on at the moment, but my house isn't very well insulated. It matters how well insulated your house is, as Lee was saying earlier. If our house was better insulated, then it would still be warmer than it was, than it is now, because the heating went off maybe an hour and a half ago or whatever. And our house is the opposite of Lee's. It's considerably warmer downstairs than it is upstairs. It's like an A-framed house, and upstairs is, you know, like a wooden timber A-frame with tiles hung on the front, and it was done in the 1960s. And apparently, according to my neighbour, if you take the tiles off, there ain't much behind them anymore. And the wind goes down the eaves. In the kids' bedrooms upstairs, it does get pretty chilly, especially at this time of year when it's been down below zero. So yeah, we got the opposite problem. But it just goes, that's why people are trying to get people to insulate their homes.
Look at you two with your posh problems of having two levels of a house. Only got one. Anyway, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app if you have any comments or questions for the team. Anything you'd like them to look into, if you'd like to tell us how hot your home is right now, please do, Simon.
Yes, you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. Maybe don't email us and tell us how hot your home is. Tweet us at thisismoney and tell us how hot your home is. You can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcasts to find all the podcasts past.
Marvellous. If you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.